New grants seek to help ranchers protect their livestock from wolves. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. We'll also tell you about the growing curiosity over who Governor Bullock will appoint to fill Max Baucus' Senate seat. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a University of Montana researcher studying the impacts of concussions on the brain. Montana is distributing its first-ever grants to prevent wolf predation of livestock. The state's Livestock Loss Board awarded a total of $100,000 in federal money to six projects in areas facing some of the biggest problems from predators. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says it's part of the board's wider effort to protect ranchers' bottom line.
Risk from wolves is high there, and conflict will probably continue in the future.
Sitting in on a meeting of the Livestock Loss Board, you get a sense of how often this happens.
That they're having larger mortality than they've had in the past there.
92 dead animals have been recorded by the state so far from last year. Cattle, sheep, or horses killed by wolves. The state also just started keeping track of bear kills last fall and has recorded four of those. The Livestock Loss Board will pay ranchers for animals the state confirms were killed by wolves or bears. It's about $900 for a cow. But that does not cover all of the costs to those ranchers. For one, there are the kills which can't be confirmed to be from wolves, like when there's not enough evidence left to confirm anything. There's so much predation from other predators like coyotes or mountain lions that isn't covered by the state at all. Also, a new study from the University of Montana shows a bigger economic impact to ranchers from predation than just the dead animals. Calf weight loss.
The effect was approximately 22 pounds less than what the average calf would have weighed had a depredation not occurred.
That's Derek Kellenberg. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of Montana and a co-author of the study. It looked at wolf predation on 18 western Montana ranches over the last 15 years. So if one cow is killed on the ranch, on average, the calves that year weigh 22 pounds less. Kellenberg says there are just theories at this point as to why that may be. Maybe the calves move to areas safer from predators, but with worse food sources.
There are theories that they tend to keep their heads up more, looking for predators rather than keeping their heads down.
Maybe they just move around more and burn more calories. Maybe the mother cows produce less milk because of stress. Whatever it is, 22 pounds less per calf makes a big difference when it comes time to sell them.
About $6,700 in lost sale weight across the rest of the herd for the average ranch.
Our board does recognize that the weight loss is a huge issue.
This is George Edwards. He's the executive secretary for the Livestock Loss Board. He says the board has never had the resources to compensate ranchers for this indirect cost.
In the event that we did, the amount of money that would be needed to cover that would be astronomical.
But the board does have one new tool, and that brings us back to the meeting.
Beaverhead County is the number one confirmed kills, at least.
Members are listening in on speakerphone to insights from Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Wolf Management Specialist Nathan Lance. The board is distributing $100,000 in federal grant money secured by Senator John Tester's office. There are grants for prevention projects like creating a carcass disposal facility in Madison County so more predators aren't attracted when the animals are buried on a rancher's property, or hiring more ranch hands in certain areas to patrol for wolves. Board Secretary George Edwards says these prevention projects are a start. Because that UM study, while it found those higher indirect costs after an animal is killed, like from the money lost from the calves weighing less, that same weight loss and those same indirect costs were not found in ranches without kills, even if wolves were on the landscape. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, the state's campaign finance regulator is asking a judge to rule that a Montana legislator illegally accepted corporate contributions and to remove him from office. Commissioner of Political Practices Jonathan Modell filed the complaint today against Republican Representative Mike Miller of Helmville. The case has been assigned to District Judge Kathy Seeley. The following is the first enforcement action taken since Modell began his investigation into complaints of illegal coordination between dozens of Republican candidates and the secretive conservative group Western Tradition Partnership in 2010. Modell has issued findings of illegal coordination and unreported contributions against four other legislative candidates in 2010. He opened investigations into complaints against four more today, including Senate Majority Leader Art Wittig. Miller says he did not violate any laws and declined further comment until he hires an attorney. Responding to Republican legislative leaders' request for transparency in the selection of a replacement to U.S. Senator Max Baucus, Governor Steve Bullock said state law leaves the decision to him and that the appointee, quote, will represent the interests of all Montanans, end quote. Bullock has kept silent on the candidates he is considering and the selection process he will undertake in finding a replacement since President Barack Obama nominated Baucus to be the next U.S. ambassador to China. A confirmation hearing for Baucus is scheduled for Tuesday before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and the Montana Democrat also must be confirmed by the entire Senate. If he is confirmed and resigns his Senate seat to take the post, Bullock will select an interim senator to fill Baucus's term until January of next year. Earlier this month, Republican leaders sent Bullock a letter asking the Democratic governor how he intends to identify and select a person, when the process will begin, and how he plans to include the public. Bullock responded by letter yesterday, saying state law gives the responsibility of a temporary appointment to him and that he takes the responsibility seriously. Senate President Jeff Essman, one of the authors of the original letter, called Bullock's response a non-answer. Once there is a vacancy, Bullock said he expects to move quickly. Several people have shown interest in the interim appointment, including Lieutenant Governor John Walsh, who is running for the Senate seat in this year's election. Former Democratic U.S. Representative Pat Williams also has said he would consider it. Montana Public Radio will have full coverage of the Baucus confirmation hearing next week on Montana Evening Edition. Ronan City Council relieved the police chief of his duties after receiving complaints that he did not show up for work or cooperate with other law enforcement agencies. Mayor Kim Apersbach says Valent Maxwell was terminated earlier this month after less than 3 months on the job. City Council member Chris Adler tells the Missoulian that a Lake County deputy said Maxwell left when she asked for his help with a hostile suspect at a hospital. Adler also alleged Maxwell told a Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribal police officer that, quote, this was the last time I helped the tribe, end quote, during a joint incident response. Maxwell told the council he couldn't recall leaving the hospital or the conversation with the tribal police officer and suggested his blood sugar medication may be to blame. A trucker suspected in the hit-and-run death of a man on Interstate 90 in South Central Montana has been arrested. Sweetgrass County Sheriff Don Tonrud says 45-year-old David Welk was arrested last night just outside of Grundy Center, Iowa. He appeared in court this morning and waived extradition to Montana. Tonrud says the Montana Highway Patrol will transport Welk back to Montana. Prosecutors believe Welk was driving a semi-trailer on Interstate 90 near Big Timber early on September 30th when the truck hit and killed 81-year-old LG Bedford of Wasilla, Alaska. Welk became a suspect after his driving partner called the Montana Highway Patrol. A government warning about the dangers of increased use of trains to transport crude oil is giving a boost to supporters of the long-delayed Keystone XL pipeline. U.S. and Canadian accident investigators urged their governments yesterday to impose new safety rules on so-called oil trains, warning that a major loss of life could result from an accident involving the increasing use of trains to transport large amounts of crude oil. Pipeline supporters say the warning highlights the need for Keystone XL, which would carry oil derived from tar sands in Western Canada to U.S. Gulf Coast refineries. North Dakota Senator John Hoeven said the years-long review of Keystone has forced oil companies to look for pipeline alternatives in the booming Bakken region. The Missoula County Elections Office wants to recruit up to 800 election judges for the 2014 and 2015 election cycles, but so far is falling short of that goal. County Clerk and Recorder and Elections Department Supervisor Shira Scott says they've reached less than half, about 47% of that recruitment goal. Scott says the judges play an integral role on local elections.
They aid voters in submitting their ballots. They help process the ballots. They help stuff ballots and get them out in the mail. The election judges that we're looking for now will also be directing voters on election day. They'll be helping with late registration and ensuring that, that everyone is able to vote. They're all over the place. So they are the polling place managers that you see out in your polling locations, but they're also the individuals that help run the fairgrounds while we're conducting an election, and they're also here in the office.
About 375 people have so far signed up to work as a Missoula County election judge.
I'm not sure that people really think about it this time of year. We're not in the middle of an election right now, and it does take some preparation and some training for these judges. So I don't believe that it's really on people's minds.
Scott says the county's goal of recruiting up to 800 judges is higher than normal, and the request is made in the name of efficiency.
We'd really like to limit the time that electors are at the polls. So we want to minimize the amount of time and make it really easy for people to vote and to vote quickly. The more election judges that we have, the easier it is to get people through the lines, to get their questions answered, to get their needs met. So that's why we're hoping for more this year.
Anyone 18 years and older and registered to vote in Missoula County is qualified to serve as an election judge, and they are paid positions. The amount of pay depends on the particular job. To find out more, visit MissoulaVotes.com and click on the Election Judges button. Over 400 entries from 27 countries applied to participate in the first stage of the NFL and GE's Head Health Challenge. 16 organizations are receiving $300,000 each for research on better diagnosing and treating mild traumatic brain injury. Two University of Montana researchers, Drs. Sarge Patel and Tom Rao, were among the winning 16 selected. The NFL and GE announced the winners of the $20 million project yesterday. The NFL has been under pressure for its handling of concussions, with thousands of former players filing suit. In this evening's feature interview, Patel explains to Edward O'Brien the project's potential implications extend far beyond professional football.
One of the issues with multiple traumatic brain injuries, obviously in the NFL and in the military, is a return to play. After receiving a concussion or a mild traumatic brain injury, how soon can a player or how soon can a soldier return to the field? We really don't have a very good grasp on exactly when is it safe, at a biochemical level, what's changing in the brain, and how can we detect that? And so I think the focus from when Tom and I were first interested in writing into this proposal was how they were looking for novel, new ways of addressing the issue of traumatic brain injury and detecting it and figuring out the mechanisms.
I need a working definition here. Traumatic brain injury, what is that? A slip and fall on the ice, you hit your head, you know, is it an IED or a blow by a quarterback?
It's all of that. I mean, any kind of concussive injury or even subconcussive injuries can be construed as a traumatic brain injury. It's a scientific, we look at it as a rationing of force to the brain, causing torsion, rattling
the brain,
your head rattling,
literally.
The brain literally getting impacted. A lot of it is, when we look at the mild, we're not looking at severe injury to the brain. It's all closed head injury. There's no damage to the skull kind of thing. And so that makes diagnosis harder, know exactly what's going on. So many things, biochemical connections, all these kinds of things, the activity of cells change upon these kinds of injuries. And I think with the long-term issues now that are becoming associated with multiple injuries over a period of time, say during a playing career, and then the long-term effects that are starting to manifest now with players and military vets with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which it seems to be like an endpoint or a neurodegenerative disease, which we're starting to link to these multiple head injury events.
Is a person's age, does that affect things as well? Like a high school football player gets knocked around on the field versus a 30, 40-year-old man or woman?
We're trying to figure that out. Juvenile brains, the research out there shows that there are subtle differences between the way juvenile brain responds to. But again, these are all things we're trying to elucidate and figure out.
Yeah. Dr. Patel, UM is among the 16 winners in this first stage of this challenge. How in the world did you guys bring to the table what you brought to the table?
It started, like most things, in a conversation. Tom and I, research track faculty, and he's worked with TBI models as part of his doctoral work, and I've worked with this protein, and we just got talking, and we had an idea. We did some preliminary data, and we showed that following a single injury, we saw these gross changes in protein expression throughout the brain, not just at the site of injury, for the particular group of proteins we were looking at. And once we had confirmed that what we were seeing was accurate, actually we got some money from the university through the university grant program, which was a grant from Main Hall for $5,000, and that allowed us to do some of our preliminary experiments to look at some of these protein changes and then some of the molecules that we believe might be resulting in these protein changes. And from that, we were able to get some seed money from the Montana Neuroscience Institute Foundation and the Montana Board of Research and Commercialization. With that funding, we generated enough preliminary data to put together this grant.
That's quite the investment, $5,000 and some other monies, and now it's a $300,000.
You know, we were really fortunate to obviously have the support of these groups. You know, the department has been very helpful in allowing us to continue to do this work. But the great thing about working in Missoula and Montana as a whole is you do find people will really look to see, okay, how can we help you with this? And, you know, we're working in collaboration with St. Patrick's Hospital. They're going to help collect blood samples for us that we can actually use in our studies to test to see if these molecules that we're interested in using as indicators of traumatic brain injury are actually changing in a human population.
That was my question. Yeah. Are you working with animals?
We work with animal models of injury, and based on the findings from those studies, we're trying to translate that through to, do we see these things in the human population, in the population that's affected by these TBIs? Can we discern these changes between these two groups? And then, you know, also as basic research scientists, we're really interested in figuring out the actual mechanisms, what it means for the brain when these changes occur. Can it get healthy again? Are these changes irreversible?
Is there then a second phase if they're happy with the level of progress here?
There is. There are going to be 6, I think, awards at $500,000. Through this year, we can prove our concepts, proof of principle experiments. I'm guessing from the 16, they will pick the 6 that they feel are most likely to succeed. So, I mean, fingers crossed.
No pressure.
I mean, some of the changes we're seeing, I believe, will truly manifest themselves in human beings. It was just the nature of the beings between taking from animal work to human work. There's no guarantees.
There's so much about the brain we don't know, don't we?
Yeah, it's a very, very complex organ. We know a lot of the individual systems, individual circuits, the cellular makeup, the biochemistry. It's figuring out how all that integrates. That's the tough part, I think. Historically, you know, we've learned about individual neurotransmitters, individual circuits in the brain. As our techniques have become more advanced, and some of the groups in this challenge, they do some incredible work in terms of imaging the brain, looking at complex tracks in the brain, looking at connections from different parts of the brain. These are techniques we didn't have 5, 10, 15 years ago. And so these groups now can actually, you know, if someone has suffered an injury, you can actually tell if one part of the brain is not communicating correctly with another part of the brain just based on how their connections have changed.
And then the next logical step is repairing those.
That would be one of the goals. And in doing some of these studies, while, you know, even our work, what I hope we can do is once we've isolated these biomarkers and used them as, you know, a signature of injury, okay, we know they do these things. Can we reverse them? Can we prevent them from doing that? Is there a time scale? You know, these are all questions that we can answer to better understand the actual disease process.
So, where it could eventually lead to a Parkinson's or an Alzheimer's?
All those kinds of things. And, you know, a lot of these diseases have lots of things in common. And I think this is one of the interesting things about this particular challenge is that the work that will come out of all of these projects, whether they go on to be the 6 that, you know, I think we'll find out a lot about how the brain responds under these conditions and the impact of that on other diseases too. The things that we find now in this challenge could affect Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, like all kinds of neurodegenerative diseases.
This head health challenge, what does it mean for UM students, both graduate and undergraduate, or is the benefit limited to you and Dr. Rao?
No. I mean, you know, this is part of our active research programs. And as research track faculties, we are growing our programs. You know, we have other projects going on. But we can't do the work in our laboratories without undergraduates and graduates at various levels. And that's always a very important part of any research lab, I think, here on campus. I mean, we have undergraduates and graduates in all our labs right now. You know, not to put it on money, but as funding improves, you know that. And we have more and more work to do. You need trained, educated kids to be able to help you out. And this is a great way for students to get into things that, you know, have real-world consequences. They can really help out in something that's obviously going to be a major issue here for the next few years to come, or if not longer.
I've been speaking with Dr. Sarj Patel, who, along with his colleague, Dr. Thomas Rao, one of the 16 winners of the GE and NFL's $20 million Head Health Challenge. Boy, you guys must be pleased as punch. Congratulations and best of luck.
Thank you, Ed.
Now for this weekend's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with some patchy freezing fog, and lows should be in the teens. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with patchy freezing fog in the morning, and highs should be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. On Sunday, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow. Expect some patchy freezing fog in the morning again, and highs should be in the 30s. In central Montana, there's a high wind watch in effect from late tonight through tomorrow afternoon for the northern Rocky Mountain front. Tonight, watch for increasing clouds with lows 25 to 35 degrees. Wind gusts could be up to 45 miles per hour. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies with highs 45 to 55 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 40 miles per hour in the afternoon. And on Sunday, it should be mostly cloudy. Snow is likely with highs 25 to 35 degrees. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly clear with lows 15 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies and highs 35 to 45 degrees. And on Sunday, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs in the 30s. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Haypatrick.
Nonprofit leaders joke that Missoula has five seasons: winter, spring, summer, fall, and fundraising. We're in the thick of that season now at United Way of Missoula County. We're not alone. All over Missoula, banquets are being planned and grant proposals submitted. And donors, faced with a plethora of worthy causes, do their best to figure out which charities are most deserving. What's your overhead is a common question donors ask, meaning, how much of my gift will go to programs, not administration? It's understandable. Donors want their dollars to do the most good, and we've come to believe that viewing nonprofits through the prism of low overhead is the best way to judge them. But there's growing sentiment that looking only through that prism gives donors a distorted view. Dan Pallotta got this ball rolling. He's the activist and fundraiser best known for creating multi-day events like three-day walks and bicycle rides to benefit charities. In a TED Talk last year, Pallotta said that donors place far too much importance on overhead costs. Essentially, this rewards nonprofits for how little we invest in the people and systems that could actually better equip us to effectively address societal problems. We spend too little to do too much. In the last 10 months, Pallotta's TED Talk has been viewed nearly 3 million times. Clearly, he struck a chord. Many nonprofit leaders agree with him. Our social problems are large in scale in Missoula and around the country, and our nonprofits are minuscule in comparison. Even in nonprofit-rich Missoula, our sector is dwarfed by the issues we face. Using super low administrative costs as the sole measure of nonprofit worthiness can actually prevent us from having the high impact we seek. Too many charities are rewarded for how little they spend, not for what they accomplish. Pallotta says that too many donors equate frugality with morality. He goes even further. He calls it economic apartheid. And the three most respected national charitable watchdog groups have listened. GuideStar, Charity Navigator, and the Better Business Bureau's Wise Giving Alliance have penned an open letter to the donors of America denouncing the overhead ratio as the sole valid indicator of nonprofit performance. Donors can view and sign that letter online at overheadmyth.com. After 25 years of reviewing grant proposals, I've learned to look warily at financial statements claiming very low overhead. I ask myself, what aren't they doing? Have they invested in systems that ensure proper fiscal controls and financial oversight? Do they have an annual audit or independent review? Are they providing their staff decent wages and benefits so that nonprofit service is a valued and viable career path? Are they thoughtfully evaluating the results of their work or simply counting the number of people who come through their doors? A nonprofit cannot plan for the future, hire and retain excellent staff, take risks, have a sustainable financial model, or do any of the things that real change requires unless they invest in themselves. But the constant pressure to reduce overhead means that far too many of us scrape by with the absolute minimum, fearing donor disapproval. We are usually expected to nickel and dime our way to great results. This is ironic in part because we so often hear nonprofits should be run more like businesses. Business people want us to adapt some of the best practices of their world, and we should. One of those is investing in ourselves. I know that many Missoula nonprofits operate at a level of performance and cost effectiveness that any business would envy. Money should go to programs, we hear. Well, at nonprofits, people are the programs. Abused women seeking help from the YWCA, people lining up at Missoula Food Bank, kids living in youth homes, elders whose lives are enriched by Missoula Aging Services, they're not thinking what great programs, they're thinking what great people are changing or saving their lives. If we don't invest in ourselves and educate our donors that doing so makes us more effective, then we perpetuate the myth that nonprofits can do more with less. Certainly, we need to keep our expenses in line, but results require resources, and programs that produce results in terms of lives changed and conditions improved, they're worthy of investment. Without money for salaries, benefits, rent, equipment, the much reviled overhead, charities cannot fulfill their missions. No money, no mission. So, during fundraising season and throughout the year, let's remember that the health of our nonprofits depends in part on what we invest in ourselves, and that without investing in ourselves, we will never meet the needs that we want to meet and that our community expects us to meet. Let's put an end to the overhead myth.
Susan Haypatrick is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.